If you guys are dying to hear me have a fangirl moment, episode number 23 is for you. So this episode of the Nerd's Guide to Financial Independence podcast features the one, the only Paula Pant of Afford Anything. I am obsessed with Paula. She has taught me so much about real estate and mindset and financial independence, and I love this episode. I also specifically chose episode 23 because I thought Paula should have a special number. And I was looking at my episodes and I'm like, which number is the best coming up? And she's kind of the Michael Jordan of the FI community in my eyes. So number 23, here we go. Hey friend, I'm Sarah, and welcome to the Nerd's Guide to Financial Independence podcast. I am here to show you that financial independence can be for anyone who wants it badly enough, and that investing in real estate doesn't have to be scary, take a vast DIY knowledge, or involve heaps of debt. When I am not sharing my own progress to FI, I'll be picking the brains of fellow like-minded, debt-conscientious investors. I am so glad that you are here, my fellow aspiring retirees. Hey guys, sorry for the interruption, but I really wanted to come on here and talk to you about the management program that I use to manage my real estate properties. And it is called Avail. If you have not heard me talk about it, I'm extremely obsessed with it because it is like cozy on steroids. So I do all of my tenant screening through there. I can do background checks, I can do criminal checks, I can do eviction record reports. You can have the tenants pay for their own background checks. And you can also push your advertisement for your properties out on various platforms. And once you get it listed, people can apply. You can add custom questions to your pre-screen. And then once they're in, you know, the system and you've chosen your tenant, they can do all their rent collection through there. They can put their security deposits in. They can show proof of insurance. And my absolute favorite part, which is really hard to find, is it is a one-stop shop because I can do all of my lease forms electronically. Goodbye paper. This is my favorite thing, especially as a real estate investor that has aspirations to be a passive investor. I want it all to be able to be handled on my phone, and I can do that with Avail, which is awesome. So if you want to check it out, I highly recommend pop over to Instagram, go in my bio, click on the link, and right at the top, you're going to see my favorite, you know, landlord software right at the top called Avail. Please go check it out. Hey everybody, I'm Sarah and I'm here with Paula Pant today. And we are very excited to talk about her brand new deal on a duplex in Indianapolis. But before we get there, I'll kind of let Paula talk about her story a little bit and kind of how we got connected. So I've been following Paula for years now. It seems like I feel like I'm a little bit of a fangirl. So this is a pretty awesome moment to get to talk to you in person, or I guess Zoom virtually, but actually face-to-face on our Zoom call, which y'all can't see. But I originally started following Paula because I wanted to get into the world of real estate. And I was kind of afraid of a lot of the mainstream ideas about really leveraging as much as you possibly could and ending up with hundreds of units, you know, people aspiring to 1,000 units. And that just didn't seem like what I wanted. And I, you know, have been following some FI bloggers and things, and a lot of them weren't doing real estate. And so Paula was kind of the first person that was using real estate to achieve that financial independence and totally spoke to my personality because she's like, you don't need to be handy. You don't need to work in your business and you can totally do this with a few doors. And so that's, you know, how did you kind of get started in this crazy world of real estate and kind of with that differing perspective, I think is interesting in this area. So,
yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on.
Yeah.
This is a lot of fun, and we've been chatting on Instagram for a while. So
yes.
It's been fun. It's like fun to actually to see your face and
yes.
to talk, to realize that outside of Instagram, there are humans have lives, you know,
like it's very fascinating, isn't it?
Right. When you know someone just on one platform for a while and then you like, they become more multidimensional. So thank you for having me on. So in terms of your question was how did I get started in real estate? But I would say like to zoom out even further, the bigger, like, it wasn't so much that I got started in real estate, like I did, but that was one subset of overall getting started as an entrepreneur and an investor. Yeah. And so real estate was one of the many incarnations that that took.
Yes.
But it was only like one of many slices of the pie. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't, and I think that probably speaks to why my voice ended up being very different than that of the community of other real estate investors out there who are like, leverage as much as you can, grow as much as you can, get 100 units in the next 100 days.
Yes.
You know, like, the reason that I've taken a more conservative, debt managed, slow growth, single digit number of units type of approach is because real estate was never intended to be the thing that I was going into. Mm-hmm. It was just one of many different types of investments in the way that, you know, I also have index funds. I also have some individual stocks. I also have some cryptocurrency. And so, in the same way that there are crypto investors who have just like gone super YOLO.
Yeah.
And they've put everything they have into crypto and they're like, they're all in. And then there are people like me who are just like, this is kind of interesting. I guess I'll download the app and I'll like, you know, come up with some portion of my money that's like not overwhelming. And I'll sort of play with this and I'll learn about this for a while. And so that same approach that I took to crypto is comparable to the approach that I took to real estate.
Yeah. And I think maybe it is, yeah, kind of, I love the zoom out idea because it's kind of like you're solving the puzzle as to you want to be kind of this financially independent and you're building around the lifestyle you want. And so it's kind of like solving the income equation and what you're going to like, what resources you have to live off of. Is that going to look like index funds or crypto? It's kind of like the why behind it. And I think people get into real estate just to get into real estate sometimes. And you came at it kind of more of a practical standpoint of solving, you know, how are you going to achieve this lifestyle where you aren't dependent on a job?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And a lot of it, it was also like, I wanted to just diversify my various investments. And so, you know, a lot of the people who are full scale in real estate they're all in. They don't really have much money in index funds or in, you know, like locked up in a 401k or in mm-hmm. any retirement funds other than maybe a self-directed IRA that's also invested in real estate.
Yeah.
and so that single-mindedness has never appealed to me.
Right. And I love the diversified aspect. And I think that was one of the blogs that also, you know, stood out to me is you have several posts where you kind of draw these parallels between real estate and the stock market, which I find interesting. So I always go back to like your nice article on like the 1% rule where you talk about, you know, when you're being mindful as to you only have a certain amount of money and you have a certain amount of time and where are you funneling that money into? Are you choosing to stick money into index funds, which are super passive, like you just set and forget and you pick your favorite index fund, or are you going to take the approach to real estate, which is significantly more work? And so there has to be like justification there and numbers to hit and kind of metrics to be mindful of where you decide like which, I guess, bucket you put your money into. And I think that's where your 1% rule article got really fascinating because it talks about kind of that gut check numbers that you can run to see where to put that money.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Because I think that was kind of interesting too, because we're in such an inflationary period in time right now with all of these stimulus packages, which are fantastic now, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And I think real estate really hedges against inflation a lot. So it's kind of interesting to think about, you know, if that 1% rule will change over time, because essentially I think in your article, because it's one of the few ones I've ever seen where it really breaks it down, is you're saying like 1% over 12 months, for example. So, you know, 12%, and then you subtract out inflation for your return. So we're getting more to, you know, 7-8%. And so you want to be at least beating what an index fund would be in order to put your money into real estate. I'm doing a terrible job explaining this, but I don't know if you want to explain it a little further, or how do you decide which tool or what vehicle to put your money into? Is that still something you use, or what are you kind of using to decide?
Yeah, absolutely. So the main criteria that I think about is what's known, it's referred to as the cap rate. Mm-hmm. And the cap rate is analogous to the dividend that a stock would pay. So any asset, like whether it's a stock or a piece of real estate, any asset earns returns in two ways. One is the capital appreciation or the gains that that mm-hmm. asset makes. And then the other is the dividend or the income stream that it pays out. And so a share of Coca-Cola or mm-hmm. Nike or Tesla, any of those are hopefully going to grow over time. But then also they pay out a recurring dividend. And you think of a house in the same way, or a piece of property in the same way. The value of that property hopefully will grow mm-hmm. over time. It may not, but hopefully it will. And so that's the capital appreciation on the property. And then on top of that, you've got that dividend. And so if you strip financing, just for the purposes of that initial decision-making, mm-hmm. strip the financing out of the equation, strip the mortgage out of the equation. Mm-hmm. We'll put that to the side and look at that later. But before we get there, first, let's just take a look at hypothetically what kind of returns you would get if you were buying the property in cash, because that way you can truly make an apples to apples comparison between real estate and stocks. Mm-hmm. Because if you were buying stocks, I mean, unless you're buying stocks on margin, which I hope you're not, yeah. then you'd be buying stocks in cash. And so in order to make that apples to apples comparison, you know, let's put the mortgage aside. Don't worry about that right now. We'll get to that later. And let's look at it in an imaginary world where you could do both of these deals in cash. What kind of returns would you get? And so with a property, what the 1% rule does is it assumes, or it essentially says, hey, if this property can collect gross rent that is 1% of its purchase price every month, then that's 12% a year, right? Mm-hmm. So if it's a $200,000 property that rents for $2,000 a month, cool. Then it's collecting that 1% per month, 12% a year. Now, if we assume that roughly half of that is going to get gobbled up by all of the various operating expenses, vacancy, repairs, maintenance, major capital expenditures like replacing the roof, the windows, the siding, homeowners insurance, property taxes. If we assume that all of half of that rent will get gobbled up by that, then the other half is what remains as that dividend or that income stream. Mm-hmm. And so if we keep 6% as a dividend or as an income stream, and if we very conservatively assume that the property will keep pace with inflation, and historically inflation has been around 3%, so let's just use that as a conservative inflation estimate, then a 6% dividend payout plus a 3% inflationary increase, that means that this property conservatively would be collecting a total of 9% return mm-hmm. in, you know, unleveraged. But of course, the objection that I hear is like, it's even in markets in the Midwest and the South, like, okay, forget about the high cost of living areas. Forget about New York, San Francisco. Of course, you're not going to find anything there. Mm-hmm. But even in markets like Indianapolis or Cincinnati or Cleveland, you know, it's even in those markets, it can be hard to find properties that meet the 1% rule. Mm-hmm. And so to that objection, which I've been hearing more and more these days, and I encountered that as well, looking for properties in Indianapolis. Let's zoom out and ask ourselves, what are we actually trying to accomplish? What matters is not specifically the 1% rule. Mm-hmm. The 1% rule is a tool for trying to find properties that have a high likelihood of getting a 6% dividend, mm-hmm. you know, or a 6% cap rate.
Yep.
And so ultimately what matters is, does this property receive a 6% cap rate? So properties, for example, properties that are newer or have been recently renovated have, at least for the first 10 years of ownership, lower repairs, lower maintenance, lower capital expenditures because they're either new or they're recently renovated. And so as a result, those operating expenses are lower. Properties that are in very popular areas that have low vacancy rates, you know, have lower operating expenses because of those low vacancy rates. right? Properties in areas with lower property taxes, even something as simple as that. Like all of those play into what those operating expenses are. And if the operating expenses are, let's say, 4% of the, 40% rather than 50% of the total gross rent, well, boom, that automatically improves your dividend right there.
Right.
Yep. So, you know, the 1% rule is a tool. Think of it like if you're on a dating app and have some like broad criteria for who you want to, who you would be willing to like swipe, what is it, left or right? I don't even know. Like, so you set your broad search.
I think there's a song that talks about swiping left.
Like you set these really broad parameters, right? You know, you want somebody who's like, who lives within 25 miles of you and who's between the ages of X through Y, right? So you set these like very broad filtering criteria, but that's not like cut and dry. It's just meant to be broad filtering criteria in order to narrow down the universe of like potential like prospects that you're looking at. But if you find a property that doesn't meet your strict filtering criteria, but it seems to be a good property, you don't eliminate that property just because it hasn't met that the filtering criteria. You know, you look at the specifics of that particular property and say, does this property produce the return that I'm looking for? And if it does, then it doesn't matter if it meets your filtering criteria or not.
Right.
Like it's not the filtering criteria that matters. The filtering criteria is just a means to an end.
Yeah. And I love that analogy because the market's so hot right now. I've adjusted my filtering criteria. So this hits home, and I think it will hit home for a lot of investors, is I have this filtering criteria and it's resulting in zero homes being emailed to me because the market's just really hot right now. And so then I realized, I specifically talk a lot about, so I'm like hunting for houses with walkout basements to convert into duplexes. And so I've like doubled my price range and I'm pulling houses that would never work as investment properties, but trying to tease through if they could have accessory like units on the property. And so it's a little more manual, but it's kind of the same, you know, analogy where you might have to broaden it up because there may be opportunity there if you can get like more out of your investment. So if your taxes on a property aren't as high, or like there's a county in my area where taxes are so low. So I'd be, you know, around that 40% more for operating costs. So yeah, it's a good point. So you focus on cap rate. And so you're looking for probably around a 6. Is that what you're...
Yeah. Ideally, I would like a 6 cap, but of course, that's also going to depend on whether it's a Class A, Class B, or Class C property. On a, I'd say 6 cap for Class B is like kind of where I anchor. So if it's a Class A property, I'd be happy to take a 5 cap, or even a 4.5 cap on a Class A property.
Yeah,
like depending on if it's like A minus or A plus. Like if it's like A plus plus plus, like I'd even go down to a 4 cap for that.
Yeah. And for people that are newer listening, so when we're talking about cap rates, this is a good guide in kind of rating properties. And so there's no like magical place you can go online to see what a property is rated. So like an A, B, or a C. But I think like your A properties, like Indianapolis is super easy. It's like your A properties will be near like a Whole Foods or like a Trader Joe's or a Starbucks. Yeah,
exactly.
In like a subdivision, maybe. And so those will be your nicer homes. Your C class neighborhoods are more, you know, working class homes, and a lot more management is tied to that. But again, it's a lot more affordable. And so your cap rates get higher as the properties become more affordable, but it also takes a lot more hands-on investing. So
exactly.
To kind of give the newbies a baseline here. So when we're talking about cap rates, I think these are really similar. This is right on the numbers that I kind of watch for as well myself. So aiming for, yeah, the 6% cap or better, but I tend to gravitate towards B neighborhoods in general too. So
nice.
Yeah. So how does your Indianapolis duplex compare? So if people haven't been following you, you recently bought an out-of-state home. So you're technically based, what do you consider your home base?
I guess Las Vegas is like my, that's where my primary residence is. That's where my permanent home is, but I'm pretty nomadic. So I'm there some of the times and then I'm just like wandering wherever the rest of the time.
That's fantastic. So Yeah. So I guess based in Las Vegas, but you recently purchased a house. So you just, have you officially closed on it yet, or it's still in closing?
Yeah, on Friday. So exactly, what, 6 days ago?
Congratulations.
Thank you. I guess tomorrow will be my 1 week anniversary of owning this property.
Yes. And so I was very excited to talk about this because I think a lot of people are having to get creative with where they're finding properties. And I think this is a good example because this is actually the second duplex you've almost purchased in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. There's kind of lots of layers to this story where I guess we could start talking about the house you passed on and then maybe work towards your deal. And we'll share some little nuggets along the way of reviewing the numbers so you can kind of get a real world example of what we're talking about.
Well, rewinding even behind beyond that, the decision to go into Indianapolis in the first place.
Yes.
So I know you live in Indiana.
I do.
Even though I grew up in Ohio, I have never actually been to Indianapolis prior to 2 months ago. Which sounds rather sad. Like I've been like to Cambodia and I've been to Australia. I never actually made it to Indiana.
It's not very exotic. I mean, Indy is a beautiful city. Indianapolis is great, but yeah, I don't think it's going to hit many people's bucket lists like the other places have. No one dreams. It's not number one on anyone's bucket list to visit Indianapolis, Indiana, even though it's a lovely city.
I will say I have learned Indianapolis apparently has excellent sushi. I was not expecting that.
Yes.
But because it's a transit hub, so a lot of fresh fish flies through there. Mm-hmm. So Indianapolis gets really fresh fish and as a result has amazing sushi.
Very interesting. I know some good sushi places, but so I work with coworkers that are living all across the United States and they're like, we're not traveling to Indiana and eating sushi. This is scary. Like they're like East Coast, West Coast. And they're like, you're a landlocked state, but apparently we're a hub. So now I know something because I'm like, I swear the sushi is good here and you're not going to get whatever, you know, foodborne diseases you're imagining right now. She's in a landlocked state. So we're a hub. I know I learned something new.
Yeah, you're a transit hub. So depending on where the fish is pulled from, you might be getting it fresher than some of the coastal areas.
Interesting. Yeah, that's fascinating. So, okay. Well, now I have a little more street cred amongst my coworkers when I suggest this amazing sushi restaurant.
In the middle of Indiana.
There are no oceans near here, but this is going to be great. It just sounds terrible.
So how it all started was I was hanging out with Rich Carey, who is also a real estate investor. He's been on my podcast, the Afford Anything podcast. He's been on that podcast a couple of times and he's a good friend of mine. He was passing through town one night. And so we like went out drinking, as you do. And at the end of the night, one of us was like, we should take a real estate scouting trip sometime because he has 30 units in Montgomery, Alabama, and he, you know, he's long talked about wanting to diversify outside of the Montgomery market because Montgomery is so heavily dependent on the military base there.
Yeah.
And so as long as that base stays open, he feels confident that Montgomery will be stable. It will always have jobs. It will always have a population. Like it's a stable market with, you know, with great tenants. But if that military base were to ever close, which there's no indication that it will, but just if,
right. Yeah.
He'd be screwed basically. Yeah. Like Montgomery really depends on that.
Yeah.
And so being so heavily dependent on just one base to stay open, like having so much of his net worth tied up in this one if, like having to go right, I think has long made him a little bit nervous. And so for a long time, he's talked about diversifying by expanding into a different market, but he's never quite known where. And similarly with me, like my properties are in Atlanta. I've long wanted to diversify outside of there. Mm-hmm. I looked at both Montgomery and Birmingham. And so for a long time, I was thinking I would invest there. But there was something, I don't even know why. Like I was looking at, I looked at Birmingham for years and years and years. And on paper, everything seemed great. I can't articulate any reason why I wouldn't. Like I still think it's a great market. But for reasons that I cannot explain, there was just something inside me that never had the motivation to mm-hmm. like go for it. And I still don't know why that was. It was just like some, yeah.
We have these gut instincts. I'm working on listening to mine.
exactly. Mm-hmm. So Rich and I were like, let's take a real estate scouting trip somewhere. And Rich had met a handful of investors who were all based in Indianapolis. And he was like, let's just go there. And I was like, cool, that sounds great. Yeah. So in January, we both went to Indianapolis for the first time. Neither of us had ever been there before. We spent 3 days there. Before going, we did a bunch of online research. Mm-hmm. So I, like you were talking about, like, I went to Google Maps and I looked up, all right, where are the Whole Foods?
Yep.
Where's the Panera Bread? Mm-hmm. Where are the breweries? Yes. Like those are clearly going to be the class A areas.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, where are the payday loan businesses? You know, where are the title shops? Like that's mm-hmm. where typically those are going to be the class C neighborhoods. I looked up places of interest, like where do they keep the children's museum? Where do they mm-hmm. keep that, you know, I looked up I Googled like, should I move to Indianapolis or like thinking of moving to Indianapolis for a job? Mm-hmm. And then I read all of the forum threads. Cause you know, on everywhere, like Yelp and Reddit, like you have all of these discussions from people who were either born and raised there or who are moving there for work or thinking about moving there for work or mm-hmm. had lived there. Like, there's a lot of online discussion from people who are not real estate investors, but who just in the course of their lives lived or have lived or are thinking about eventually living there. And those are great resources for just learning what people say about different neighborhoods. Where do they recommend? And so I did a lot of that online research in advance mm-hmm. of going out there.
That's very interesting. Yeah. So did you already have some places you wanted to visit before you guys went, or did you have like on the ground tour guides of the city?
Both. So we, by the time we showed up, both Rich and I separately had our like list of neighborhoods that we wanted to drive around, and we mm-hmm. had like Google mapped it, you know? So we're like, all right, we're going to rent a car. And then on the day that we land, we're going to drive these neighborhoods. We're going to make a mm-hmm. big loop and we're going to drive here and here and here and here and here. And then we're going to go to dinner in this other neighborhood so that we can see what that place is like at night. And then the next day we're going to meet with, and so then that following day, we set up a meeting with this particular real estate agent and he drove us around to a bunch of like various neighborhoods. So we had that tour going through him mm-hmm. On the second day. And then on the third and final day that we were there, we had our little driving tour, mm-hmm. partially on our own and then partially with like a local investor who showed us a few other places that we had not even noticed before.
Very so, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a combination of doing a bunch of Googling ourselves and then also meeting local real estate agents and local investors who like took us around. It was like 50-50 of each.
Yeah. And all probably people you connected with online, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So again, I think a lot of people, we talked about this a little bit, as people think you have to know someone in the city or have family or be familiar, and there's so much homework you can do. So I think this is, prep is important. If you're, you know, in one of those high cost living cities thinking you can't invest in real estate, I think this is a really good example of like, you have no intention of moving to Indianapolis, but you're building connections there and you're building relationships there. So I think that's really wise and something a lot of people are kind of scared to do. And
You don't need any, you need an internet connection.
Yes.
Like that is the only connection that you need. You need internet.
Yes. We all can hopefully get that. I've been the person that is like left my house and sat at McDonald's because I live in the middle of nowhere and like stole their Wi-Fi. So if you don't personally have internet, you can drive to McDonald's and get on Wi-Fi as well. And you know, you might be fancier than I am and go to a Starbucks or something, but yeah.
I've definitely done that pre-pandemic, paid the Starbucks internet fee, the Starbucks loitering fee, as I call it.
Yeah, pretty much. So definitely a possibility if you guys have those internet connections to, you know, get out there. But I think it's really a mindset thing where if you're just determined to make it work and find deals in no matter how hot the market is, you have to get creative. And I think a lot of people are kind of stuck in these limiting beliefs and don't let their brain kind of get creative with where they could invest and how they can build out teams and things, even you know, across the country. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good example of making it happen when there's millions of people online saying deals can't be found right now. So
yeah, the naysayers. Kind of
interesting. The naysayers. Everyone will have, there's so many naysayers in real estate. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
But I think homes kind of touch everybody. And I think that's something I've learned, because in like, no one's out naysaying as much about index funds. And so when you pop into real estate and everyone comes out of the woodwork to give you their opinion on why you shouldn't be a landlord, it's kind of earth shattering at first. And then you're like, okay, well, everyone's going to complain because everyone's owned a house and everyone's had a problem or knows someone that had a problem with the house, whether they're renting or owning. And so I think that seems like there's so many more naysayers in this area. So I guess step one is ignore the naysayers, ignore all those limiting beliefs you've thought about, and, you know, kind of go after it is my tidbit from this long distance landlording adventure you're going on.
Well, a lot of people do it wrong. Like, a lot of people think that just because they have lived in a house, that means that they're qualified or like know how to invest in one. Yeah. And those are two very different skill sets. Like, the fact that I have drank a Coca-Cola doesn't mean that I know how to analyze like the quarterly earnings reports of the Coca-Cola company.
Right.
But with real estate, it's a lot of people just kind of assume that. And so like Alyssa, one of the students in my course, she told me, she was like, I was really hesitant to invest in real estate because I have these friends who like just had this nightmare scenario. She's like, and then after I took your course, I realized, of course they had a terrible experience because they did everything wrong. Like they were very much the like, oh, if the rent covers the mortgage, we should be fine type of people.
Gosh. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, I have no words. No.
Right.
But people don't know what they don't know, right. I guess, which is why you need to like do your homework. And yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
You don't know that the question, does the rent cover the mortgage, is the worst question that can be asked of all real estate questions. Pause. I think we probably both have posts on this where I'll get on my soapbox about this is a terrible question to be asking because there's so many other expenses associated with owning a home beyond your mortgage. Taxes and insurance. Sometimes people leave that out of the whole mortgage equation. You have, you know, someday something's going to break, like a furnace, or your house is going to need a new roof. It's a home. Like, things go bad and break in or go wrong. And so you have, you know, I think people are shocked when they learn that you hold back like 40 to 50% of your rent to cover your expenses. Like, half of your rent goes to that. And if you're sitting there hoping the mortgage is just covered, that's a terrible, you can imagine that equation does not balance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I think people don't think about that wisely because you essentially plan for half your rent to just go to, you know, costs of owning the property beyond the mortgage. So yeah. People miss that a lot. So what else did her friends do? So they were hoping their mortgage would be covered. So I guess they're going about it backwards.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. She didn't get into the details, but she was just like, she was like thing after thing after thing. Like, my guess is like, kind of from the way she was talking, that they weren't treating it like a business. They weren't building processes. They weren't building systems. They weren't, they didn't know how to properly analyze properties. Like, they were just sort of, I don't know, flinging their money at it and hoping it would work out, which is, I think, what a lot of first timers do.
Yeah.
And that's just the worst way to do it. And if you do it that way, then yeah, you are likely to get burned. Like, the odds are stacked against you. If you, it's like going to the gym and like on your very first day there, picking up a 200-pound weight and then being shocked when like you injure yourself, you know, like, of course you injured yourself. You got in over your head and didn't know correct form and didn't know what you were doing, you know?
That'd be like if you asked me to go to the gym and run a mile. Like, it's not happening anymore. 16-year-old me could do that fresh, but now I can't. Like, there's just no way my body is going to be able to do that. You know, could you train up to it? Yes, but you're not going to hit kind of home runs in the beginning. So yeah, or do your homework and do your prep. There's preparation involved in running long distances when you're 30. After you've kind of learned the Indianapolis market a bit, where does your story kind of go from there?
Okay, so then after leaving Indianapolis, so we spent those 3 days there, and then I really liked the real estate agent that I'd connected with on that trip, and he was recommended from some of the other investors, the local Indianapolis-based investors, who, like, I'd heard, like, multiple investors recommended him. So that boded well for like, I was like, cool, I want to use this guy.
Yes.
And yeah. I should say also, I made the decision, like when people are looking for real estate, you can find on market or off market deals. Mm-hmm. And if I was doing it better, I would be looking for off market deals. Right. Like if I was really doing it better, I would be sending out direct mail campaigns. I'd be driving for dollars virtually. I would be, you know, like I'd be creating deals rather than trying to find deals. And that's a distinction. But because I'm lazy and because I have other priorities, I decided I knew that by looking for MLS deals, for publicly listed deals, that means necessarily I'm going to be getting a deal with a lower return. And I very consciously accepted that as like, cool, that's a trade-off I'm willing to make in order to preserve my time and energy. So
yes, exactly. And I think it depends on your goals too, because most of my houses are also bought off the MLS. And I think it's, you know, if you're not trying to scale quickly and you're not trying to buy hundreds of properties, you can be patient. You can watch the MLS for an entire year until you find the one house that year that works. And I think that's what people don't think about kind of on a grand scale. But if you're like, I want to buy 5 units this year, the MLS in a hot market is not going to give you 5 properties. So you have to, you know, like I've decided that I'm kind of at the point where I would like to buy a few more. And so I'm about to do my first direct mail campaign because I'm like, I'm not going to sit here and find stuff on the MLS anymore if I want to achieve where I want to go. And so it's kind of a gut check because for some people, it totally works for your model. And it did for years for me to wait until the MLS yielded something that hit my criteria.
Right.
So I think that's something too. Like I could afford to be lazy for a while. And now I'm like, okay, let's take this a little bit more advanced and let's try something new. So you can always pivot too.
Exactly.
Yes. But I was very pro lazy route to get started as well. I guess if that's a thing, I think we're still very active people, even in the MLS. So, so MLS was where you're going to go to kind of monitor deals.
Yeah. So MLS, working with an agent, and I knew from the trips to India, I knew that Indianapolis is a city that has a lot of duplexes. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I could get the numbers, like the numbers are never going to work on a single family home.
Right.
So eliminate right off the bat.
Yeah.
Multi-unit properties are generally broadly my favorites.
Yeah.
But in terms of like I wasn't seeing a lot of triplexes there, and most mm-hmm. fourplexes were like class C.
Yeah.
And I wanted class B, B plus, you know, and so those were mostly going to be duplex. If I wanted multifamily in like B plus, in that B plus, A minus range, B plus, A minus is a stretch. Those were going to be duplexes. So I knew just from that 3-day trip, just from like driving around and looking at those neighborhoods, that I could tell my agent, like, I'm specifically looking for a B plus or better duplex, that ideally is at least close to the 1% rule. You know, it doesn't need to be precise, but it needs to be like in the neighborhood. And so and I'm happy to get a fixer upper.
Yeah.
And so he brought me a bunch of, you know, a bunch of deals. Yeah. Like, you know, basically every day he would text me like some deal and I'd be like, nope. Yep. Nope. Maybe. Nope. And for a lot of them, I would just make lowball offers. Like I found that he brought me the first offer that I made was a 8-unit building. and it was, to this day, I'm still kind of like, that might be the one that got away. Cause like that building had been on the market for 75 days.
Yeah.
And so I was like, ooh, it's been on the market for that long. I bet I can really lowball them. So they're asking $475 for it. I offered them $400. And like my offer just happened to come in right at the same time as somebody else's. And so even though that property had been on the market for 75 days, if I'd been like 5 days earlier, I could have gotten it at that lowball price, I think. But two offers happened to come in right at the same time and the other people didn't lowball them as much as I did. So that one was still like the one that got away.
Yeah.
That was just like bad timing.
I think we all have that house. We're like, oh, that could have been really good.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't get the eightplex and then I made a bunch of offers on various other duplexes. And then there was one that was totally under construction. So it did not have walls or floors.
Wow. Like
it was all down to the studs.
Yes.
Completely. So everything was roughed in, like the electrical, the plumbing, all of that was roughed in, but it didn't have like finished electrical, finished plumbing. Of course, it didn't have walls. It didn't have floors. It didn't have, any of like the finished mechanicals.
Yes.
But like, it was a really nice place. Like very, very good neighborhood. And, it was the floor plan, the layout, like it was set up to be a really nice, like big 3-unit, 2-bath. They had built in and gotten all of the proper permitting to sell off each unit separately. So it would technically have been like 2 townhouses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for somebody who wanted to flip, it was mm-hmm. an amazing deal. So I went under contract on that one for $370 ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
And in my head, I was like, okay, if I can finish this out for another $100,000, be in it for $470 total, and then rent out each side for like $2,200, $2,300, mm-hmm. So like that would be what, rent of $4,400 to $4,600.
Yeah.
Total.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'd be super like having something that is essentially brand new So having new construction, where nothing's going to break for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
and, collecting that level of rent, like I'd be happy with that. Like right. That would be a great investment. So I went under contract on it, flew out to Indianapolis, walked through it with 2 contractors. We spent all day like running the numbers, calculating cost per square foot, like what's it going to cost to get this thing finished out?
Mm-hmm.
And, at the end of it, it looked as though it would end up basically costing a little over $500,000, like maybe $510,000
mm-hmm.
To finish it out. And I was like, eh, that was like $30,000 or $40,000 more than what I was mm-hmm. anticipating.
I'm guessing it's all the costs of materials right now.
Yeah, lumber is so expensive at the
moment.
Lumber
is crazy. For some reason, drywall is really expensive right now. Like there's just mm-hmm. a lot of,
yeah.
I'm wondering if that's what like tacked on your price. So things are a little insane right now because my remodel was super over budget also because I didn't account for how much like COVID. Basic things like trim work would, the impact of COVID on everything was just...
Exactly.
You feel it in the budget remodels.
So. Exactly. Yeah.
You're so like, maybe you need a smaller scale remodel during these times. Yeah.
Yeah. So for people who are listening, COVID disrupted the supply chain. And
yes.
as a result, lumber and all of these materials now have, as a result of COVID, have increased prices. That should hopefully change in the year like 2022. Like
yes.
when we're post-pandemic and the supply chain hasn't been interrupted as much.
Mm-hmm.
Then hopefully that will abate. But for at least the next 6 to 12 months, I see material costs being high.
Yeah.
So for people who are listening, if it's possible to defer a maintenance project for another year,
yeah.
I think there's a decent chance the price of renovations will come down in a year.
Yes. And lead time on materials is also long. I guess if people are investing in 2021 or doing a remodel coming up, mm-hmm. Like getting a refrigerator is really hard right now.
Yeah.
I actually have like a stockpile of appliances going in my garage right now because the lead time to like order an appliance package is so long. And like, if things start breaking at houses or anything, I just have a storage situation happening in my garage right now. So, but I can be a little more hands-on because I'm local, but it's just something to keep in mind where if you're an out-of-state investor, you can totally do this too, but you might want to be mindful of if you're going to do a remodel, you need more time to get your appliances in to hit, your rent start dates and things like that.
Right.
So,
exactly. Yeah.
All supply chain challenges are happening right now. So you felt that with your contractors for sure.
Exactly. So. Exactly. And so then I went back to the sellers and I said, hey, look, the cost estimate for getting this thing rent ready is like about $30,000 to $40,000 higher than I anticipated. So I'm going to submit two documents. One is an amendment to the contract in which you lower the price by an additional $40,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is a termination of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
So feel free to sign either one of these. It's up to you.
Yep.
But, yeah. You know, either we amend this contract and drop it 40 grand or we terminate. Mm-hmm. And so they chose to terminate the contract, which I don't blame them for.
Right.
And honestly, back to the, like, the one that got away, it, like, in retrospect, if I had decided, you know, because those were set up such that it would be easy to separate them out and sell mm-hmm. them individually, if I had decided that I wanted to sell one and hold the other, I think that would be great. Like, honestly, I think that anyone who flips that place mm-hmm. is going to make a good profit on it. So right. that's the type of place, and typically you see this with new construction. Mm-hmm. New construction is great for flippers.
Yeah.
So if I had decided to go through with it and I had sold one, held the other, then the one that I held would have been, you know, I mean, I guess technically it would, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes here, be a bad deal in that the profits from the one that I sold would still be tied up in the one that I held.
Yeah.
So in terms of opportunity cost of other things that I could do with those profits, yeah, am I still like paying a lot for the one that I hold? Sure.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so if you look at it from that perspective, from the opportunity cost perspective, it's not a good deal as a rental.
Yeah.
And ultimately I did walk away from it. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it from a use your properties to pay for properties perspective,
yeah.
You know, if I just executed a reno on that whole place, sold half of it, and then used the profits to pay off the other half or pay down a big chunk of the other half,
mm-hmm.
Then from a use the property to pay for the property point of view, it would have been that other half that I would have held would have been a great rental.
Yeah.
So those are like two different ways of looking at the deal.
Yeah.
And I think both of those ways are valid. I ultimately walked away from the deal just because that seemed like a lot of time and energy and money to tie up into something that would be like, you know, everything would have to work out perfectly for it to still be a good deal. It
right.
just seemed a little bit too like hairline.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to like knowing why you're investing. Like there's a reason you're not in the business of flipping houses, mm-hmm. because that's not helping build the lifestyle you want to have. Like you want like the long-term buy and hold. And
yeah.
correct me if I'm wrong, I guess I shouldn't say, I'm just telling people what I think your strategy is. So, because this would be my, I guess, looking at it is there's lots of houses you could look at to flip or sell one unit and things, but I'm not buying houses to buy more houses necessarily. So that's right. something where, you know, you can always make it work, but at the end of the day, does it really fit with the big picture? Probably not. And you have to know kind of when to let go of things because that, like 20 years from now, it might be nice to have bought more properties with that. But we kind of like, I look at my whole portfolio and I'm like, I'm kind of in the collecting business, not the flipping and selling and that kind of aspect. And part exactly. of me would like to control the other side of the wall, but that's me. Like I have control
right.
problems. Like I want to know what my neighbors are doing on the other side. So that wouldn't be super appealing to me either, which there's not a lot of money value you can hook to that feeling as a landlord.
So, exactly.
So sometimes monetary value doesn't always tie in either. So let's break down the house you did buy. So the one you just recently closed on. So tell yeah. us about that and how you found it.
So that is in an area of town. It's called Meridian Kessler. It's about a mile from Butler University.
Mm-hmm.
And right before I made an offer on that house, there was a different duplex that was very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a slightly better location. Like that other duplex was like right next to Butler University. Yeah. The one that I bought, it's about a mile away. And that particular duplex had 11, so from on the day that it went on the market, it got 11 offers on it.
Yeah.
And it ended up selling for above asking price.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, and I bid on it, but like other people were bidding it up to the point that I was like, this does not make sense anymore.
Right. Don't you wonder how people are bidding sometimes? I'm like, where are you guys getting your numbers? There's no way you're cash flowing on this, but here we are.
Well, so. I think because it's a duplex, I think the people who are bidding were owner occupants, you know, and owner occupants don't really care. Like, yeah,
right.
like the owner occupants just want a home for themselves. And if they can monetize, if they can offset some of their own mortgage expenses by monetizing half of their property,
right.
then great, that's less money out of pocket for them. But they, at the end of the day, an owner-occupant doesn't need it to make returns.
Yeah.
It's a primary residence.
Yeah.
And so I think like it being so close to the university, It's a great location for owner occupants, like if you're university staff or faculty, or I don't know, even if you're in like a, maybe a PhD, I assume they have PhD programs there. I don't actually know, but you know,
I don't know either actually. Yeah.
You know, but if you know that you're going to be at the university for 5 years or 6 years, at least, like, sure, why not get a duplex that's right by campus, mm-hmm. and, you know, have the rent from the other half of that property, you know, buy a duplex, collect rent from half of it, have that pay off the bulk of your mortgage expenses. Like, sure. Yeah. If I were a owner occupant, I'd probably overbid for that too.
Right. Yeah.
And if you're planning on walking to campus, there's a big lifestyle difference between being right next to it versus being a mile away.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And then, like, there's the whole vehicle costs and all of those things to associate if you're an owner occupant, but
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
For you, the numbers would be very different. Yeah. Because exactly. You don't care about the walkability.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I care about the rentability and the viability of the overall neighborhood, mm-hmm. but it just insofar as it impacts vacancy rates and, mm-hmm. you know, and so like I'd bid the previous weekend, I'd bid on that property and gotten outbid. And then so the next week I saw this duplex come up and it was very similar, like condition of the property, asking price, like almost all of these factors were, you know, very, very close. And so as soon as it came on the market, I called my agent and I was like, I want to tie this up right away. Like, let's get mm-hmm. this thing under, it's not dally. Let's come out of the gate with a strong offer and get this thing under contract immediately.
Yeah.
And so they listed it on a Friday. And then within a couple hours after listing it, they were like, they put up a thing where they were like, they updated the listing to be like, we're going to be reviewing offers on Monday, which meant that they'd already gotten a lot of interest.
Right.
And so I called my agent and I was like, nope, they're not waiting until Monday. Like, let's submit asking price. I said, let's submit asking price with an escalation clause up to 10,000 above asking mm-hmm. right now, but let's make that offer expire tonight at 9 p.m. So if they want it, they have to accept it tonight.
Yep. And for people who don't know, can you describe an escalation clause? Because I learned this last year and it's exciting, especially if you're new and haven't heard about this yet.
Yeah. Yeah. So an escalation clause is basically where you say, look, this is my offer, but if somebody else offers an amount that is the same or higher, I'm willing to raise my offer in, you know, $500 increments or $1,000 increments up to a maximum of X. Mm-hmm. And so by submitting my offer asking price was 299,000. So basically mm-hmm. 300,000. So I submitted an offer. I basically said, look, I'll offer 299, but if someone else comes in above me, I will automatically raise my offer by 500 in $500 increments. Mm-hmm. I will beat the other offer by $500 and I will do that up to a maximum of 310. So that's like my drop dead. I'm not going to offer any more than that. And so you typically don't want to offer with an escalation clause if you think that you're going to be the only offer, because you are like tipping your hand and letting them know how high you'll go.
Right. Yeah. Because they see all of the escalation clause when you submit. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you're like letting them know this is my max mm-hmm. and that from a negotiating position, like you don't want people to do that. But if you know that there's going to be multiple offers, then an escalation clause kind of helps you submit a lower offer, like lock in that lower offer mm-hmm. while also not locking you out of the game if somebody else beats you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the goal is to get them to kind of, because you don't want the bidding war that happened the last time. So this is kind of the strategy, is you don't want people to bid over, like so far over asking, by giving them more time. So doing the, you know, time limit that evening to try to get it locked up is a really good strategy also.
Yeah. So
there's an art to these negotiations for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so then with that, the one thing that I had in terms of a contingency, because I'm out of state, I was like, I want a 72-hour walkout clause. Like, I want to be able to terminate the contract for absolutely any reason or no reason at all mm-hmm. within 72 hours. And they came back and said, well, we're not willing to accept the offer if you've got a 3-day walkout. Like, why wouldn't we just wait until Monday?
Well, that makes sense. You know? Yeah.
And so then I came back to them and said, all right, well, tell you what then. I will submit an offer without an escalation clause without a walkout. So mm-hmm. if there's no escalation, then I'm willing to submit asking price, but nothing more than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they were like, okay, deal. So,
nice.
So that was how I was able to lock up the contract that night before mm-hmm. letting, you know, before letting them collect other offers.
Right. Yeah. And potentially do more showings and things too. So yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Very important.
But then I still had my 10-day inspection period.
Yeah.
You know,
the inspection period is pure gold. So always do your home inspection. I feel very strongly about that because the home inspection is my favorite part. And I think when you very first start out and you get like your first inspection report and it's like 30 pages of everything that is possibly wrong with your home, like you're like, my house is crap. And you're just freaking out when you get those inspection reports. But now I'm like, this is 25 pages of things I can negotiate on. So, so have you did your inspection already then if you closed? So
yeah.
How did the inspection go? Were you able to negotiate anymore? Or?
No. So I bought the property as is. So that was part of the deal. But what I love about the inspection report, and I had three inspections done. I had the general inspection, a termite inspection, and a sewer scope.
Yep.
And what I love about the inspection is it's basically like just a to-do list of like, cool, this is what I should address first.
Yep.
You know, like it, especially as an out-of-state investor, I can't be there to observe like what's wrong with the property. The inspection report is basically somebody telling me like, here are all of the things that you can, mm-hmm. you know, when you go to renovate the property or when you go to make repairs, here are the things that you should repair first.
With color photographs of all the issues. You're like, wow, that chimney does look really bad. Thank you for pointing that out. And then you're like, find a mason. So yeah, I use it the same way. It's like this is my list of renovations and you can start finding people. So.
Right. I know. I liked it so much. I looked at the inspection report and I was like, I should get an inspection done on some of the properties I already own.
Yeah. Like it really wouldn't be a bad idea. Like, is there any like deferred maintenance? They'll point it all out for me. And I'll be like, is this a deal breaker? Is this like a thing? You probably could. Yeah.
I'm seriously
take your money.
That. Yeah. Like, I don't think I'll do it right now, but maybe in a year or two, like there's mm-hmm. a triplex that I've had for, you know, almost 10 years. And I'm like, I should just get an inspection done on this property that I already own and that I'm planning on holding, like just to see what needs to be done.
And I could print like the electrical section and hand that to my electrician and I would email it to people in advance. And it's helpful to say like, here's a picture of the chimney. So when you show up, you know what you're getting. So can you walk us through the numbers on the house or what it looks like now? So what are your rents and you ended up paying $310. Is that right?
No, $300.
Oh, very good. $299 technically. That $1,000, hey, it matters. That could be one of the repairs.
Yeah, so paid $299. So right now it is being under, so it's fully occupied at the moment. It is under market value. So both sides are, if they were to rent at fair market value, each side would the total rent would, all right. I believe that the total rent would be $2,800.
Mm-hmm.
I asked a local investor who owns a property a couple blocks away to do a walkthrough and tell me what she thought the rent would be. She thinks that I'm being too conservative. She thinks that it could rent for a total of between $3,000 to $3,200.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I think that fair market rent would be $1,400 on each side times two.
Yeah.
She thinks that fair market rent would be between $1,500 to $1,600 on each side times two. I think that's a little too high. So I'm not gonna say that those are the numbers.
Yeah.
But I will say that there is a local investor who owns a duplex. She's house hacking into a duplex mm-hmm. that's like literally four blocks away. So she's an investor, she's a house hacker, she lives in the area. She thinks that my numbers are too conservative. So all of that is a very long way of saying somewhere between $1,400 per side to $1,600 per side is the fair market value of it. I'm going to go with the lower number and say it's going to be $1,400 per side.
Right. But it's always a good thing to get newer opinions too, because I think that's kind of the beauty of real estate is you can pick people's brains and then ultimately decide what hits your goals and everything like that. So both sides are still occupied with tenants?
Yeah, correct. Both sides are still occupied. One is on a month-to-month lease and the other is on a lease that expires in August.
Mm-hmm.
The one with a lease that expires in August, like I, you know, when I flew out there after I was under contract to do a walkthrough, The one with the lease that expires in August is like just taking immaculate care of the property. Mm-hmm. So I am totally willing. I would like next time I go to Indianapolis, I'm just going to take him out for a beer and be like, what do I got to do to keep you?
That's and I awesome.
Would, mm-hmm. I would be happy to continue letting him rent at this, like his current lower under market value rate mm-hmm. for as long as he wants to, because I see how, like just how clean. Beautifully he's, yeah. Just yeah. he's doing an absolutely amazing job and I want to hold on to him for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can talk him into it, if I can talk him into staying, I will.
Good job. Offering beer is always a good choice.
You know? Exactly.
Food, a meal, and some snacks. Yeah.
The person who is on the renting the other side on the month to month, not really taking such good care of it. So mm-hmm. I'm going to probably have a, you know, your month to month will not be getting renewed conversation with him at some point soon.
Yeah. Did you get estoppel agreements or anything when you did the, what's kind of in your due diligence period with your tenants? Do they give you their lease agreements, copies of that? How did all that work for this deal?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got copies of the lease agreements, prorated rent, and security deposits.
Perfect. So that's fantastic. Yeah. And then just honoring those agreements kind of until you decide to transition to your own paperwork. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think I've inherited tenants once before, and it isn't as scary as people think. I think a lot of people are afraid of inheriting tenants, and it's not nearly as daunting as you'd expect. So yeah, I think that was a big fear. Lots of naysayers about inherited tenants exist as well. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. It is nice though, like knowing that one is on a month to month and the other has a lease that's going to end in the next few months.
Yeah.
It's like, It's. I think that's kind of the best of both worlds because, on one hand, you get income right away. You know, mm-hmm. you don't have a vacant property that you're then scrambling to fill. So you get the benefit of like that immediate income, but you also have the relief of knowing that it's temporary and yes. that if you don't want to renew with these particular tenants, you don't have to.
Definitely. And I think that's great. Do you transition them at all do you have like a property management software you use or anything like that for your other properties?
Yeah, I use Cozy.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna say, are you still on Cozy? I was wondering because I think you'd done that for your Cozy. Others. So did you have to move your tenants over to Cozy when they started to pay their rent? Or are you letting
Yeah, well,
them?
It hasn't happened yet. I've only owned the property for 6 days.
Oh, yeah. For six
so
days.
I will
yeah.
be doing that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Yeah, that's so very valid.
We haven't had that situation yet.
Yes. So that's coming, I guess, is transitioning them over to kind of your systems and different things you have in place. So, yeah. Because I think exactly. those are all things to think about that people forget. Like if you're used to managing, you know, rent collection and things, you kind of have to get them all entered into your programs. So, yeah, but it's not as right. daunting as people expect transitioning folks over. So I think most people are just grateful to not have a disruption in where they're living. So that's
right.
usually a good thing.
You're
like, please let me stay here for a little bit. Like, please give me notice before, you know, you kick us out or what are you doing with the property? So always lots of questions. So I think it's more about managing expectations for people than anything else. So it's always daunting.
Yeah.
I think for them, if you can imagine like you're living in a home that's being sold, it can be a little scary because you just don't know.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that's really exciting. Congratulations on the new duplex. And I think talking through, it just seems way less frightening to think about out of state or investing, you know, learning your process because that makes sense. Because I'm like, it's kind of the same thing when you're a new landlord starting out in any area where you have to build connections and get to know people and you know, you can do that from the internet. So
exactly.
very reassuring for people in those high cost of living areas that are afraid of investing out of state. I think it's a lot of mindset around, you know, you're just going to do this. You're going to build out a team. You're going to get to know local people and, you know, make it happen. Finances wise, do you keep like emergency funds, like per property? Do you do a lot of cash reserves or kind of overall, like a money management picture, because I know you're not a big, like, you don't like the nitty gritty budgeting that like no. I do. Like I nerd out on budgets. So you're like the anti-budget person. So
exactly.
talk us through
exactly.
business and personal kind of financial planning, how you do that. Yeah.
Yeah. So for people who are listening, so the anti-budget is this coin that the term that I coined, that describes my approach to budgeting where I'm like a big picture person. I'm not very good at like details. And so, sticking to a budget, like the traditional line itemized budget where you're like, I've spent this much on toothpaste and I spend this much on sweaters. You're like I just can't do that. And so I zoomed out and I was like, what are we actually trying to achieve here? What we're trying to achieve fundamentally is making sure that we're saving enough. Mm-hmm. And I use saving in the broadest possible sense of the word. So literal savings in a savings account, additional payments towards a debt above and beyond the minimum, and you know, contributions to a retirement account, money set aside for down payments on investment properties, all of that is included in what I mean when I say the word savings, anything that improves your net worth. And so the purpose of a budget is to make sure that you're setting aside enough money for those net worth improvements. And so I coined this term the anti-budget, where I was like, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to decide on a given amount of money that I want to dedicate towards savings, meaning net worth improvements. Mm-hmm. I am going to pull that off the top first. And then whatever is left over is just what I live on. And yep. That's it. And, you know, so I don't actually track people off. People have asked me like, well, how much, you know, what's your spending? I don't track my spending. I have no idea. Like, I don't know what I spend. I track my savings. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, my spending is not what matters. My savings is what matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's so interesting.
That's how I manage my personal budget. Yes. And then for investment properties, I keep cash reserves of a minimum of 3 months of gross rent.
Mm-hmm.
And then anything that's above and beyond that, I just allow it to build up into a bank account for a while until I'm ready to use it to either do a renovation or use it to buy another property.
Yep. Sounds good. Yeah. I like the 3 months gross rent. That's a good idea as well. So, because I've heard people talk about it in terms of like furnaces, and 3 months gross rent seems a little more comforting as well. Because I'm like, you should have like enough to replace like how many furnaces you own or something like that. And I think that's a funny way of looking at it too, but it kind of makes sense in today's world of shortages. So.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. And so I've already talked to you probably over your time limit today. So I really appreciate you kind of walking us through the nitty gritty and kind of teaching us a little bit about kind of the process and the mindset behind it. And I think because you focus so much on lifestyle design and kind of living the life you want. So I don't know if we want to talk about, you know, how you got to, I guess, the idea of like having the option to do the nomadic lifestyle and that type of thing and being able to travel, because how many countries have you been to now for people that don't know your story super well?
over 40, I think somewhere, I think more than 40, less than 45, yeah. Somewhere in that range.
Yeah. And so we're both very, you know, you didn't want to be tied to like the day job in terms of your investing and things like that, which is, you know, going to be so important when you're traveling, you know, 40 plus countries. That's going to be really hard to keep. You know, you're not gonna be able to do that level of traveling when you get 2 weeks vacation a year. It's just exactly. Not gonna be sustainable.
And so exactly, exactly.
Kind of intentional lifestyle design goes into this. So what are like the biggest mindset challenges? Because you do a lot of, you know, you have this real estate course that you do lots mm-hmm. of, you know, people coaching. What are some big mindset shifts you think you watch people see as they kind of go through your course and think about?
So there are a few. So one is that oftentimes people need clarity on why they're buying a given why they're going into real estate investing in the first place. For some people, they want to buy a personal home and they want to offset a portion of that cost. Mm-hmm. For others, they want that, but they don't know they want it because it's not a personal home that they'll live in. They want to buy something for their mom or for their sister or for, you know, they want to buy something for personal reasons, even if it's not where they themselves personally live. And because it's a home that's not their primary residence, mm-hmm. they don't recognize that that's still a personal expense.
Right.
Or a personal purchase, right? Mm-hmm. And then you've got people who want to build a stream of passive income, you know, cash flow through rental properties mm-hmm. so that they can live on that cash flow while they take an early retirement or they transition to a different lower paying career, or they just generally want to supplement their income in a passive way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you've got people who just want to build a overall portfolio of investments and then have some diversification. So you have all of these different, you know, when our students enter the course, they enter with all of these different motivations. Mm-hmm. And what I think what happens, not just in real estate investing, but in all kinds of investing, is when you have people with different goals who are talking to one another and sharing mm-hmm. advice with one another, then there's like this crosstalk that happens where like people make mistakes because they're getting advice that's not, or hearing recommendations that are not attuned to the game that they're playing.
Yeah.
So when people who are playing different games all get on the same field, like that's when collisions happen.
Yeah. Right? Exactly.
And so the course starts out with like getting very clear on what game are you playing? Mm-hmm. Because that's going to inform all of your downstream decision-making. And then from that point forward, the first thing that we go into is analyzing properties. And that's like a big aha moment for a lot of people, because the math of the analysis, mm-hmm. and even for people who aren't like mathy, yeah. you know, like
yeah.
to understand conceptually, like why are we crunching these numbers? Why are we calculating these formulas? What is the root of what we're trying to understand? Like, mm-hmm. don't just hand me a formula. Like, what does this formula actually represent? Mm-hmm. You know, and why do we care about this?
That piece is critical, and people miss that because you can use a calculator and plug it all in and then it'll spit out whether it's a good deal, but I think it misses the point. And so many people are caught up on cash return, and I really don't like that metric personally. Like, I hate
that metric.
I yeah. hate cash on cash returns. Mm-hmm. I think my goal in life is to interview as many people that Same. Also hate cash on cash returns, because it makes everything look great the less money you put in. And you hit the nail on the head when we were talking earlier, where you're like, you want to take finance out of the equation when mm-hmm. looking at deals. And I learned this partly for you, but also through, I talked to Chad Carson a lot. He's just fantastic. And he also runs his math where you want to make sure the property makes sense as an investment before you ever talk about the mortgage payment. And so exactly. many people don't get that piece of the puzzle. Like, the mortgage is kind of an afterthought. Like, if you run all the numbers well and the home is a good investment, no matter what way you buy it, no matter how creative you get, no matter how big or small your mortgage is, like, it should make sense regardless. And mm-hmm. that's a big thing that I am a proponent of. So I love that you dive into the numbers and the why behind the numbers, because it's so often missed, where you're like, here's a deal analysis calculator, run your deals, look at your cash on cash return, and then keep on going. And it's
exactly
a mindful approach to the math, because it has to work with the reason why you're investing. So
right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So that is phenomenal. I like that you start there too, because I think people don't understand that piece. And like, if your goal is to scale up, then the BRRRR strategy and cash on cash return may matter. If you're going after, you know, just churning your money in deal after deal and trying to grow numbers wise. But a lot of people kind of come, I guess, to my platform and your platform for cash flow reasons or for financial independence more, or kind of that mm-hmm. lifestyle difference. And that's a whole different investing strategy, where I think you said you are a debt managed approach was your word that I'm going to totally steal. Because I'm like a debt conscientious is usually where I go with it, where I'm like, you're aware of debt, you're taking it on, like it's your job, but at least you're thinking about what you're doing a little bit more than just trying to suck all the money out of deals and continue on. So,
right. Exactly. Yeah.
And I think that's a switch that we don't hear a lot of people discuss. So I love that that's like the beginning part of your course. And you guys also go through like calculating ARV and all of the other pieces of the puzzle. So,
we don't do ARV specifically. So mm-hmm. for people who are listening, that's after repair value.
Oh yes.
And that is especially if you're flipping houses or you are doing the BRRRR strategy, mm-hmm. Meaning that you are aggressively refinancing.
Yeah.
You know, ARV is very popular among yes. that crowd.
Yeah.
We don't really go in depth into ARV. Mm-hmm. We go more into calculating your operating expenses, you know, yeah. estimating those operating expenses, estimating the total wealth creation that a given property will give you over the span of your life, or over the span of 10 years.
That's
or 20 years.
Mm-hmm. I have not done that myself.
We go deep into that because in addition to, in addition to the cap rate, in addition to the cash flow, there are all of these other ways that properties generate wealth, right? Mm-hmm. There's equity growth through principal pay down. There's equity mm-hmm. growth through forced appreciation. There's equity growth through market appreciation. Depreciation on a property and the tax benefits through that depreciation. So where we really go deep is wealth creation in all of those different forms from a given property. And so we have this incredible spreadsheet that took many people and a couple of years of iterations to develop.
Is this involve a statistician or anything to get it? Yeah, but spreadsheets are my love language. So it's blowing my mind that I haven't thought about, I could totally make a spreadsheet of breaking that all down, because I have you have your tax forms every year where you're looking at the depreciation of your assets, and you can figure out the appreciation in your market and over time. And yeah, this gets the wheels turning.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. So we go very deep into that. How much wealth will this given property bring you over the span of 10 years under this set of assumptions? And then if you tweak any of these variables, how does that change the variable? How does that impact lifetime wealth of this property?
Interesting. Yeah. That's fascinating. I've never heard of anyone doing that before. So that's a very, very fascinating approach, because it's definitely a different model than Burr, which is so big right now.
Exactly.
Very different mindset shift, because I think Burr is such a short-term focus and you don't hear a lot about long-term tracking metrics. So that's very interesting, because a lot of people talk about building long-term wealth and then use very short-term strategies to kind of get there. So including myself,
very good point.
Totally guilty of running short-term numbers, because a lot of my deal analysis is buying the property, but I haven't ever taken the time to look at the metrics kind of after very well, other than my taxes at the end of the year. So
right. Exactly.
Very interesting. So kind of give people an overview of the rest of your course, and then I'll let you go, because I've totally gone way over time.
We focus in the beginning, we focus on analyzing properties. And after that, we look at how to find deals. Mm-hmm. And we do that, there are many components when it comes to finding a deal. Do you want to find a deal or do you want to create a deal? And that mm-hmm. goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Do you want to find something that's publicly listed? So look at listings and pick something from the menu.
Yes.
Or do you want to create a deal? Do you want to go out there and hunt for properties that are not yet listed and negotiate for getting those properties, mm-hmm. the properties that are not for sale? So we talk about that whole spectrum of options and the various pros and cons within that range of finding versus creating deals.
Yes.
And then we also talk about how to do that regardless of whether you're looking locally or looking out of state. And specifically with regard to out of state, one of the big questions that comes up a lot from our students is, hey, how do I even begin to pick a location? If I live in San Francisco, mm-hmm. how do I even begin to think about if I want to buy property in Kansas versus Oklahoma versus Pennsylvania versus Missouri versus Alabama versus Kentucky? Where do I even start?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Midwest out there.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't even mention Iowa.
I know.
Right? There's Nebraska. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a lot of options out there.
I've been told you live in one of the I states. I'm like, there's a lot of it. Illinois and Iowa and Indiana, very different places. But
and Idaho.
We all, and very different geography wise, and it's very expansive. So Idaho exactly. geography and topography is going to look very different than the flat Indiana cornfields. So.
Exactly. I know. I grew up in Ohio, and people are often like, oh, so you grew up in Idaho. And I'm like, no, Ohio. And they're like, mm-hmm. yeah, same thing. And I'm like, no, not even remotely the same thing.
Yes, very different places.
So yeah, like, very, very briefly. So analyzing a property, finding properties, then we go into financing.
Yeah.
All of the various financing arrangements. And then after that, the renovations, like, mm-hmm. you know, the, like what actually goes into a property, like what is at a physical level, what is a property?
Yeah.
And how do you develop the vocabulary to be able to talk about a property? What is mm-hmm. flashing? What is fascia? What is a soffit?
Yes.
So we go into all of that. Then we go into like building your team, mm-hmm. How to build a team, how to interview agents, how to interview property managers, how to build a team from out of state, you know, how to evaluate your team. We go through all of that, how to manage the team. We go through what comes after building your team. Oh, the actual buying and negotiating part yes. of it.
Yeah.
Like escalation clauses.
Yes.
You know, so we go through that as well. Jeez, there's a, now that I'm naming this, there's a lot in there.
There's a lot in there. Yeah, there's a ton. I'm like, there's lots of things. Yeah. Because there's so many levels and like facets. I feel like you could pick apart each individual section of buying a house. There's a lot more layers that people don't expect. And, you know, I think a lot of it's trial by fire. And so it's nice to have your course and kind of the experience you've had with like negotiating deals and doing out of state to kind of, you know, bring some of that home so people don't have to learn the hard way like a lot of us do.
Exactly.
So I'm like, I know to get like copies of rent agreements because I've been down the road where you don't get copies of, you know, or where they don't want to give you copies of the leases, which is crazy.
Right.
But it's a very interesting world out there. So lots of, and every house teaches you something is what I'm learning.
Totally. Totally.
Oh, it's definitely a hard, you know, school to learn from, but it's also so much fun. So it gets very addicting once you get into real estate. And I think that's probably one of the big benefits of, you know, courses is having this cohort of people kind of going through similar experiences. So it's definitely a fun yeah. option to do. Now I'm thinking about doing the course. So I haven't done your course yet, but I'm thinking about doing it just to learn from the calculator because you sold me on big Excel spreadsheet. Like I might have mentally committed at that point. So. Awesome. I'm like, I want to learn like the lifetime of my properties. That'd be fantastic. So that's where my mind goes. That's my takeaway from today is I really want to think about, you know, the long-term strategy because if you're a long-term buy and hold investor, I should be looking at the long-term viability of my properties. So one of my big things I talk to everyone about for my final question, because everyone has to have like a token, I think final question on a podcast is I tend to outsource things where it's not, you know, worth my time and energy to do things. Like one of my big things is I do lawn care now at my house hack. So I kind of put that into the whole rent equation. So I don't have to mow my own lawn because it's on an acre and I have a toddler and that was just like time I didn't want to spend. And so what kind of things in your own life do you find yourself kind of outsourcing or saying, you know, your time is your most valuable resource. So what do you, you know, divvy up or pass out? Like even whether that's business or personal, we can kind of go any direction. What are things you farm out to others to get your time back?
Well, so a lot of it in terms of running Afford Anything, like the team has grown fairly significantly. And so, for example, course administration, we're hiring on a full-time or almost full-time person just for that.
That's awesome.
So because there's so much that goes into course administration, like, you know, we have active investor mastermind calls, we have TAs, and somebody has to manage those TAs. And the TAs are then, you know, in the forums, making sure that if somebody asks a question in the forums, that question gets answered immediately.
Yes.
So we need TAs who do that. We've had TAs that have led strategic mastermind groups. We have TAs who, you know, so we have like all of these TAs who make sure that the students get the one-on-one attention that they want. Mm-hmm. And then we need somebody who like manages those TAs.
Yeah. And then how many TAs do you have now that help with the course? Because you have a lot of students going through.
We do. Yeah. We have 1300 students. And so let's see, there's Diana, Karen, Natalie, Jess, and Sam. And then we're hiring for one more right now. So
that's
there's
awesome.
Six. Oh, and that not counting Alyssa. Alyssa's like lead. And Alyssa's like the lead TA who's going to become the course administrator.
Wonderful.
And so then right now we have a Erin who's working as our course administrator, but once she can, once we hire Alyssa and she transitions off of that, that will free up more of Erin's time to do things like, she does video editing. She manages my calendar in terms of, just things like this, like managing scheduling for interviews, you know, this sort of a thing.
Which I loved her job title, I think, on the emails. Like, it was like chief, like chaos officer or something. Like, it was just so witty.
Chief sanity officer.
Chief sanity officer. I'm like, I feel like I need one of those. Like, I just need handlers. That's kind of where I'm at. I'm like, someone like keep me on task. So exactly. I would love an Aaron. I think that'd be my first role I'd hire out is a sanity officer.
Exactly. So she handles a lot of the operational, you know, like my scheduling and like people come to me all the time with pitches for like partnerships and you know, like there needs to be through Afford Anything, there just needs to be processes for all of these things. Like people are constantly DMing me being like, hey, you know, we'd like to be on your podcast. And like, when I used to like respond to those, like when I was just responding to those by being like, oh, gee, what's this person all about? Let me look them up. Like that's not an efficient way to do anything.
Right. Yeah.
And so then we needed to have a guest intake form, like a, you know, a proposal form where we would gather all of these intake requests. And then we would structure time on the calendar where once a month we look at all of these requests and we go through them all and just, you know, decide yes or no. You know, similarly with like people reach out and they have questions. And if somebody's in my, a student in my course and they've got a question, like we have a structured way of doing that. We've got office hours that happen once a week. So I make sure that the students in my course get like time with me because that's, you know, they've paid for that, you know?
Yeah.
But when just random people who listen to my podcast reach out and they have a question, like I can't just be doing that for free all day.
Right.
And so, the way that we handle that is we funnel them to, leave a voicemail for the podcast, but we need a whole system for that. Like, somebody's got to set up the software that collects these voicemails, and then somebody's got to listen to the voicemails and schedule them out and assign, like each voicemail gets assigned to a particular episode, right? And so that needs to be scheduled out. And then the show notes need to be written around that. And then every voicemail needs to be properly marked in a certain way. And you know what I mean? Like there's just a whole process around how we manage all of that. Yeah. Like there's a
it has to be automated.
There.
You're only one human.
Exactly. And it just has to be processized. Like the parts that do require human touch or human judgment, like listening to the voicemail and deciding which episode to assign it to, right? We don't want five voicemails that all have the same topic to go into the same episode that's going to make for a boring episode.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So there needs to be that human element of decision-making of what episode is this going to go in? You know, or if a question is more timely, like if it deals with taxes, we might try to push it up and get it into an episode that airs before tax day.
Right.
You know, so like that human judgment, like that, it can't all be automated. It does have to be there, but we do need a human. We need a process for that. So we've occasionally had people who just email us and they're like, I recorded an MP3 and here's me emailing it to you. And we're like, oh, hell no, 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 no. Like, cause that it breaks the process. It breaks the system, you know? And anytime somebody is trying to unautomate the system, like they don't understand what they're actually asking of us. Like to them, they're just sending us an MP3 with a voicemail.
Yeah.
To us, it's a complete breakdown of the system of our entire system.
I have the same like, oh no reaction when tenants like, can you print me like a paper form? Like, no. This is a test whether you can be passive, you know, as passive as possible. And people ask, like how many questions people ask from, you know, property being listed to doing like my online pre-screen to like going into, I use Avail now. I just migrated from Cozy. And so they go into there and everything's automated and I have like electronic leases to end the program. And like, how many questions take in that process? Let me know how much of a pain or a breeze you're going to be as a person. So when people ask for paper requisitions, it's like that email with an MP3 file where you're like, this doesn't go into my beautiful workflow that I've spent all this time figuring out. So
exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I'd say that to answer your question about delegation, a lot of what I do is create workflows, create processes, and then, you know, build up a team. Afford Anything now has, we have 15 people who work in varying capacities. Erin is the only, Erin and I are both full-time, like with health insurance benefits,
awesome.
You know, like W-2 employees with health insurance. Yes.
So legit. Look at you.
I know, right? And we're adding number 3 this year. So we're going to add a third W-2 employee with health benefits. Nice. So the goal is to basically, I'd like to grow at a pace of maybe like 1 to 2 full-time employees per year for the next, yeah. you know, year, couple of years. Mm-hmm. I think that's like a reasonable growth pace.
Yes.
But yeah, a lot of that is like, it was, especially when a company is so small, figuring out roles and figuring out where people are going to go and how these processes and systems are going to get designed.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually don't do a whole lot of outsourcing in my personal life.
Yeah.
Like most of where my brain space goes is creating efficiencies inside of the business.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense. Yeah. But I think that's the ability, like where you've gotten to where you are today because of that like mindset on efficiencies in the business. And I think that's something I feel like I delegate pretty well in my own life, and I'm working on translating that over to, you know, the platform and growing a business. But I think it's, again, the mindset of like, this is a business that you're approaching. Right. Because it's very easy for me to think about real estate as a business, and Instagram was kind of like a fun project. And now to kind of switch gears and build out both is interesting. So it makes sense. That's where you picked up the most efficiencies in kind of building out that platform. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for all of your time today. I really appreciate it. And we've gone totally over. So thank you for talking to me for so long today. This tends to happen, but I love the deep dive through your duplex. And I love the mindset work kind of behind the scenes that I think a lot of people, you know, being really thoughtful on how you choose your path in real estate, because there's so many different ways to go through it, and making sure it just aligns with where you want, because they may not like my approach or your approach, but figuring out what they need, mm-hmm. Versus just like blindly following someone, because that's like the new buzz term, like really thinking about, is this like building the life I want to have? And, you know, I think that's so important. And so I always find it fascinating to talk to you, because you think about things like the big picture things so well. So
thank you. Thank you.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. I hope you have a wonderful afternoon. And
thank you. You too.
This has been fun.
Bye. All right. Bye.
Gosh, did you all just love this episode? I hope you're enjoying each of these podcasts as much as I am. If you are, please go subscribe to the podcast and spread the word by sharing your thoughts on Instagram. If you are not already aware, I'm pretty much obsessed with Instagram, so seriously, come find me. Instagram is the place where I'm going to announce every new podcast episode. I also share new products as I post them into my store. And I also am just going to be oversharing way too much about my personal life as a DIY landlord and a working boss mom. Thanks so much for listening.